For the last 2 months, millions of Kazakhstanis have been transfixed in front of their screens. They weren't watching the latest binge-worthy Netflix series, however. Instead, for the first time in Kazakhstan's history, the nation was watching a live-streamed murder trial on YouTube. This was the trial of Quandiq Bushenbaev, the former Kazakh economy minister, who, on November 9th, tortured and killed his wife, Saltanat Nukanova. Rarely has there been such brutal CCTV footage of domestic violence. Clips of Bushenbaev strangling and kicking the 31-year-old Saltanat went viral on social media, even transcending Kazakhstan's borders. However, Kazakhstan's macabre relationship with domestic violence did not start in March with this trial. In fact, Kazakhstan's endemic culture of domestic violence has been consistently swept under the rug, despite the fact that around 900 people have been killed as a result of domestic violence incidents in Kazakhstan over the past 5 years. Following the USSR's collapse and the partial repudiation of the Soviet project, Kazakhstan saw a shift from Marxist ideals to nationalist ones that emphasized traditional gender roles. Gender equality is often portrayed as a threat to patriarchal traditions, thus exacerbating the problem of domestic violence. The prevalence and increase of domestic violence in Kazakhstan is largely due to inefficient legislation. For years, the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, international organizations, and local NGOs have urged Kazakh authorities to enhance domestic violence laws, but to little avail. Following the news of Saltanat Nukanova's brutal murder, many people were outraged, and the hashtag ZaSaltanat, meaning for Saltanat, began trending online. The only concrete outcome of this trial so far, however, is a new law, now called Saltanat's Law, which criminalized battery and intentional harm to help, and passed on April 15th. On May 13th, Bushenbaev was sentenced to 24 years in prison, charged with torture and murder. This result has provoked conflicting responses. Since years ago, the authorities would have felt quite comfortable giving Bushenbaev the usual sentence of 6 to 7 years, even though many believe he should have received a life sentence. So why was this trial so different? Why does domestic violence remain such a serious problem in Kazakhstan? And what are the cardinal reforms necessary to create real and lasting change? To get some answers to these questions and more, I spoke to Colleen Wood, Professor of Political Science at Century College, Dinara Smailova, the human rights activist and founder of the Nemolchi Foundation, and Alexandra Konaeva, Editor-in-Chief of The Village Kazakhstan. Welcome to The Naked Pravda. Hi, my name is Ekaterina Ralbor, and I'm an intern at Medusa. I'll be your host this week. My first guest today is Colleen Wood, a researcher on human rights and digital politics in Central Asia. We discussed the Bushenbaev case in detail and delved into how Saltanat's law falls short of effectively preventing domestic violence. Why is the topic of domestic violence so prevalent now after being on the back burner for so many years? And what makes the Bushenbaev trial so unique? Is it that Quandiq Bushenbaev was part of the so-called golden elite and he had the support of former President Nazarbayev himself? Or is there a convergence of reasons that this trial has taken Kazakhstan by storm?
A big question. So I think that this trial has been a kind of lightning rod for attention at domestic violence stems from the fact that the details of the case are really, really brutal. Like the way that Quandiq Bushenbaev murdered his wife, Saltanat Nukanova, was awful, objectively terrible, gruesome. I don't want to go into too many sort of gory details of what happened, but even if it had just been Golden Boy beats his wife, hurts his wife, kills his wife, I'm not sure that without the level of goriness and the way that he did it and the kind of brazenness in which he and his family member kind of hid it, that there would maybe not have been as much attention at the case. But you're definitely right in saying that this that I kind of Bishimbaev was a member of this golden elite definitely contributes to public interest in the case, at least in Kazakhstan. You know, Bishimbaev got tapped to be an assistant to President Nazarbayev when he was just 29 years old. He first became a minister. He was the minister of economy when he was 36 years old, like really young to be stepping into these big roles, probably due to the fact that his father was a member of parliament. But this golden boy status didn't protect Bishimbaev under a previous court case. Like he had been sentenced for bribery back in 2018, sentenced to 10 years. But this like golden boy status did lead to his being pardoned, having his sentence commuted. So he only served a year and a half of his 10 years. So I think that this case, in addition to kind of drawing attention to the need for protection for women, where in Kazakhstan, there's a huge problem with domestic violence, spousal violence, but there's this big question mark around how is the Tokayev administration handling rule of law? Like, to what extent is someone who was formerly so closely involved in the Nazarbayev regime, has enjoyed a lot of privilege and status, like, is this person going to face the rule of law and the consequences that are written in Kazakhstan's criminal code? So within Kazakhstan, I think that that's where the attention really draws in. But the puzzle of why has this case captured international attention? Like, YouTubers from Russia are posting videos about this that are getting millions of views in a week, in just a few days' time. The question of why do Russians care so much about the Bishimbaev trial is a whole other thing. But within Kazakhstan, I think just the details, the goriness, the brazenness with which Bishimbaev murdered his wife really sparked rage from the population and frustration with this level of impunity that people who work for the government maybe have thought that they enjoyed until now.
Would you say it's fair to say that there's a factor at play whereby people have been harboring resentment for so long over the injustice of having one set of rules for the elite and others for, you know, your average citizen, that it kind of just all alighted on this Bishimbaev case and thus opened a floodgate of resentment that had been there for years? So actually the Bishimbaev trial is about more than Bishimbaev.
Certainly. And there was a line, let me pull this up, that it's a really great line from one of the lawyers, Igor Frantsev, who was a lawyer representing Saltanat Nukyanova and her family. He kind of, in his closing statement in the trial, goes on this, rampage. Like, he's speaking really, really passionately. And he's saying, you know, by recognizing that Bishimbaev is guilty, you're freeing all of Kazakhstan and all of our people from elitist parasites. So he really leans into that kind of almost populist language of, this is not just about Bishimbaev atoning for what he did to Nukyanova. This is about, like, the government of Kazakhstan atoning to the people for, being able to get away with not following the rules that have been in place.
Just to go back to the goriness that we talked about, I mean, rarely does one see such disturbing CCTV footage of domestic violence. And I mean, as you said, it just went absolutely viral on social media, even outside of Kazakhstan. And do you think that Gen Z actually played a large part in not only broadcasting and circulating Saltanat Nukyanova's story, but in promoting discussion about domestic violence?
I'm not sure whether it is something that could be attributed to Gen Z in particular. When you look at data of who uses social media and who uses the internet in Kazakhstan, there's obviously a lean towards younger people. But the activists who have been working long, long, long before the Bishimbaev trial to draw attention to domestic violence, to try to strengthen protections for victims of domestic violence, of sexual violence, of rape, I think many of them are not Gen Z, that they are millennials, Gen X, even older than that. So there is definitely a crew of activists and people who are really savvy with leveraging social media platforms in Kazakhstan to draw attention to social issues. And that's not something that I would say is unique to Gen Z, or that I wouldn't say that Gen Z is driving this push for more protections.
Many claim that this trial was a litmus test of President Tokayev's promise to strengthen women's rights. Has he passed?
I'm not sure whether this is a litmus test for Tokayev on protection for women, on the status of women in Kazakhstan. I see it more as a test of rule of law, of to what extent is the judicial system independent. And during the trial, Tokayev signed a piece of legislation that's going to kind of bring back criminal penalties for light battery, like very low level abuse in the home that had previously been illegal in Kazakhstan. In 2017, they were decriminalized. So it's not even really like new expansive protections for women. It's just reinstating the status quo that had been broken away in 2017. But also during this trial, there was reform that's passed the first reading in parliament to change the way the jury trials work in Kazakhstan. That really, I think that the litmus test for governance has to do with the extent to which the jury was independent, the jury was protected and shielded from media attention during the trial, the extent to which the judge was independent and able to manage the courtroom against this golden boy elite and his well-paid team of lawyers. That I see as a bigger litmus test that Tokayev has probably passed. The degree to which this was a litmus test that Tokayev created for himself seems like a plausible explanation. So the choice to do a jury trial at all was up to Bishimbaev. He, as the accused, opted in to have a jury. But this was the first trial in Kazakhstan that was live streamed. And that decision was not Bishimbaev's. That kind of comes from higher up in the regime. And kind of a brilliant move, this live streaming of this trial has opened up a level of transparency and also sparked this cultural obsession. Everyone in Kazakhstan has been talking about this. People in the Russian-speaking world have been talking about this. So all attention is on judicial independence in Kazakhstan because of a choice to make this live streamed. So yeah, in terms of the litmus test of does Tokayev pass on protecting women, not really. If all that you've done is reinstate pretty weak protections that existed as of 2017, I don't think that enough has been done. And local NGOs, international watchdogs have called the regime out on this. The branding, the way that it's getting covered in media is Sultanat's Law is this great thing for protection of domestic violence victims. But it really is not comprehensive at all. It doesn't protect against stalking, psychological abuse, financial abuse, really even most forms of physical abuse, that there's a lot of work that can be done to institutionalize protections for women, that this is basically just getting the country back to square one, where it had been in 2017.
We'll get to the legislation slightly later, just to finish with the Bishimbaev trial. Obviously, we need to talk about the result. He was sentenced to 24 years. I think from what I've read, there's been slightly conflicting emotions surrounding it within Sultanat's family itself. Actually, I mean, moments before the result came out, her father said that any ruling other than life in prison would be considered unjust. But then you see footage after the trial where her brother says that he kind of anticipated this result. So how can we come to terms with the result? What is the overall feeling within Kazakhstan?
Yeah, the question of whether 24 years is enough is a really, really intense emotional question, normative question. And within the family, I can't imagine the grief that her parents, her brother are going through, and both having to process her death and then having to sit through this trial where really intimate details of her life, her personal life, private life, have been broadcasted not only to the people in the courtroom, but to the whole country. I really feel for her family of having to just deal with these layers and layers of grief. In terms of zooming out from her family to kind of broader social consensus on whether this is enough, I've seen in kind of following big YouTube blogger pages and following Instagram pretty closely. And these are platforms where a lot of socio-political commentary happens in Kazakhstan. One thing that I've noticed is a gap in tone in language. So for videos and posts that are put up in Russian, a lot of the comments in Russian kind of speak to this not being enough. There's hashtags, justice for Sultanat. There's kind of demands that he should have been put in for life, which is a technical possibility under the law, but would have required a unanimous vote from the jurors. The fact that Bishambhai got 24 years still speaks to a high level of agreement among the jurors, but just not quite unanimous. But so yeah, in Russian, people are demanding life. Like, this is not enough, more. And in videos and posts put up in Kazakh language, the comments then also in Kazakh kind of speak to, like, it does seem just done. It seems that our courts and the judge were fair. They were just. May God respect the results of this outcome, kind of appealing to religiosity, appealing to the fairness of the court system. So that kind of opens up interesting avenues for research of what is driving this maybe differentiated reaction based on if people were following coverage in Russian or in Kazakh. Maybe that kind of riled up different expectations for how does the justice system work? What are the possible outcomes of the case? And two, I think that there was just a lot more Russian language coverage of this, both domestically and internationally, that may be driving that difference. And of course, as a generalization, there were comments in Kazakh saying that this is not enough. Fine, let him have his 24 years in prison for this, but then another 30 on top for every year of Sultanat's life. Like, comments like that appeared in Kazakh. Comments saying that the judge was fair also appeared in Russian, but I did notice that pattern.
Is it fair to say that most men, and actually women around and in Kazakhstan, do not view domestic and sexual violence as a problem that needs solving because it is so ingrained within the patriarchal setup of society? I mean, there are countless stories of domestic violence being passed off as familial issues that you therefore can't meddle with. Do you think this kind of mode of thinking will continue post-trial, post this whole surge of sentiment against domestic violence?
I think that there's definitely survey research in Kazakhstan and other Central Asian countries that people are maybe, at least in the past, have been content with the degree to which the government is involved in protections for women in handling domestic violence, which may result from them just not seeing this as a problem. This is a private sphere thing. This is not a public sphere issue. But as big cases, the Bishambhai case has not been the only flashpoint case in the last 5 years that draws attention to sexual assault and sexual violence. I think that there is this kind of growing awareness beyond the emotional, psychological, physical costs of domestic violence that this is a bigger socioeconomic problem that needs to be addressed collectively. So, you know, there was in the U.S. the Me Too movement, and that gets translated into Russian, that there's a group called Ni Malchi, Don't Be Silent, Kazakhstan. And in trying to draw attention to the pervasiveness of domestic violence and sexual assault, helping people see that they are not alone and trying to problematize that idea that this is something that a woman just naturally needs to handle, to bear the brunt of. Trying to kind of poke holes in that and help people question, like, maybe you don't need to live this way. This isn't the natural order of affairs.
So on to the legislation. Obviously, Sultanat's law, which passed on April 15th of this year, did not just come out of a vacuum. What are some of the key moments leading up to the adoption of this legislation?
Yeah, how to draw the timeline of this piece of law. I mean, yeah, so going back to 2017, I think I mentioned that it was in 2017 that Kazakhstan decriminalized beatings as something that could be met with fines or arrests. And activists pushed back on that, that they were really concerned about the potential consequences for that decriminalization. Kazakhstan had also previously decriminalized rape, lowering it from a serious crime to a moderate crime. And in 2019, there was a pretty awful case on a train involving a train worker raping a young woman asleep. And that kind of sparked a flashpoint where you both have hashtag campaigns, digital campaigns of people sharing their own personal stories, push for legislative reform to bring back, to like re-amplify the seriousness, the weight of the consequences. Since 2019, has been a pretty concentrated push to focus on that. But these kind of, I don't want to call them anecdotal, but yeah, these like hashtag campaigns where people are sharing really powerful personal stories. Yes, those bubble up. They, in aggregate, tell a really powerful story about the kind of overall state of domestic violence in the country. But I think that there's also been, since COVID, an effort to apply more rigorous empirical approaches to understanding the state of domestic violence. So there was a nationwide survey published pretty recently in April where the study worked from 2019 to 2022 and was surveying almost 15,000 women across the country about their experience with domestic violence. And in this effort to study the extent, when you have those types of numbers, when you can see in percentages just how pervasive the experience is, that it's not just really young women, it's not just wealthy women, or it's not just poor women, like trying to get numbers, I think helps to justify the demands that activists have been making for a long time, that the country needs stronger protections. So those types of empirical efforts have been popping up more in the last few years. These kind of really large end surveys, big interview projects, they've been drawing really important attention to the issue.
And where does the bill fall short? I mean, considering domestic violence isn't even considered a standalone offense in the criminal code, it doesn't feel like the justice system has a zero tolerance approach to domestic violence.
Yeah, no, it definitely does not. What some local activists have been describing is that basically what Sultanate's law puts into place is like criminalizing battery, like light beatings, but the beatings need to be bad enough that there's like visible evidence that it happened. It still puts the onus on the person who is being hit, the person who's being abused, to know all of the steps of how do you bring your husband to justice? How do you bring your father, your brother to justice? Do you have the kind of space and capacity to find evidence, to take pictures, to go talk to the police? That this still is a really heavy burden on victims to prevent that. What I also found really curious while reading the bill is that, yes, there's this kind of tacked on bit about recriminalizing battery, but a lot of the bill has to do with protecting children from bullying, protecting children from putting penalties if you're found to have somehow contributed to a minor committing suicide. You face really intense penalties for that. And so I think that the framing around calling this Sultanate's bill, calling this a piece of legislation for women, for protecting against domestic violence, is an interesting framing from the government, given that there's a kind of tone around protecting children, protecting not quite sanctity of marriage, but it's framed as like a trying to protect families was the tone of the actual text of the legislation. So this does not give the Kazakh government or justice system a lot of teeth to like go after people who are perpetuating abuse in their houses.
Central Asia specifically, and actually all the post-Soviet states, are they all facing the same problems with regards to domestic violence and gender inequality, or is one ahead of the other, and if so, why?
Yeah, I don't think it's fair to lump all 15 former republics together of like, here's a kind of post-Soviet condition with gender-based violence. I think certainly there was a kind of regime, if you will, of gender relations that was pushed under Soviet rule, really strict definitions of womanness, maleness, what a family is, what roles these people are supposed to play. And there's certainly some degree to which there's like a legacy of Soviet gender relations, but clusters of countries have kind of gone in totally different directions, socially, politically, economically, religiously. So for example, like thinking within Central Asia, like Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan are some of the poorest countries, not only in the post-Soviet region, but in the world. Huge numbers of men and women go to Russia, go to Turkey for labor migration, totally changing family dynamics, totally changing the stressors and pressures on a family and kind of opening up opportunities for people to get away with harming their children, harming their spouses. And that looks really different from, say, Moldova, also a post-Soviet country, also quite poor, the poorest country in Europe, but there's just really different social, religious, political dynamics in place. The proximity to Europe, I think, is kind of maybe bolstered rule of law a little bit. You can then jump to Ukraine, where since the large-scale invasion began in February 2022, for families that have remained, it's just the immense stress of living under constant bombing, of constant threat of Russian invasion, like domestic violence and beatings and men hurting their wives and their children has skyrocketed. And that's, I don't think, anything particular to the post-Soviet region. Evidence worldwide shows that during wartime, violence against women increases. But yeah, so I think that trying to make any broad sweeping claims about this being a post-Soviet issue mask some of the like micro conditions that are happening in each country.
Since people cannot rely on the authorities for support and protection, human rights organizations have been forced to step up. Which NGOs have managed to make a difference, and are there any particular cases or stories that people should know?
Yeah, it's tough to answer. I mean, so I think there's a pretty vibrant culture of civil society in Kazakhstan. The academic and often journalistic focus on civil society tends to be on these like big activist groups, the ones that are calling for political reform, like my own research included. But I think that we're maybe missing data on how many NGOs are working specifically on supporting women, supporting families. The government's kind of crisis centers or places where women might be able to go after they leave their husbands, leave a kind of dangerous family situation, are underfunded. There aren't that many of them. And civil society is basically left to fill in the blanks there. So this is kind of an under-examined question. But in terms of NGOs and activist networks that are making a difference on drawing attention to the issue, on making a lot of noise about needing more legislation, needing more protection, the big one that comes to mind is Nemolchi Kazakhstan. However, in the last several months, the founder of Nemolchi, Dina Tansara, she led Kazakhstan in 2022. She moved to Georgia under fear that the government was kind of making a case against her, fabricating a politically motivated case. And since November, Nemolchi has been under investigation for alleged fraud. So there's this tension of, yes, Tokayev has like supposedly passed this litmus test of protecting women. We got Saltanat's law passed, but at the same time has been targeting this organization, which has been doggedly pushing and advocating on behalf of victims of domestic violence for years now, and kind of in doing so, acting as a thorn in the side of the government. So Nemolchi, the story of Nemolchi, I think, is one to really be paying attention to in the next few months.
We had this one case in Kazakhstan that was really famous, quite recently actually. A girl named Urjan was raped. A police officer came to her asking her to just resolve things and make up with the guy. She was able to record the conversation, how they were trying to talk her out of involving the police. She begged, explaining that it was rape and that he should be punished, but the police didn't listen to her, and so she took that tape and released it. And we could all witness how these investigations really happen.
Next, Sam Brazil, Medusa in English's senior news editor, interviewed Dinara Smailova, a prominent women's rights advocate from Kazakhstan and the founder of the foundation Nemolchi, which means don't be silent. They talked about why domestic violence remains so pervasive in Kazakh society and the sharp backlash she's faced for working to hold perpetrators accountable.
According to the head of the Public Interest Protection Service of Kazakhstan's Prosecutor General's Office, at least 80 women in Kazakhstan die at the hands of domestic abusers every year. Meanwhile, every day, police in Kazakhstan receive an average of about 300 reports of domestic violence. Why does domestic violence remain such a serious problem in Kazakhstan? Why did the Bishimbayev case go differently? Was it just because the murder was captured by security cameras?
Journalists learned about it from the moment it was released, and the Sultanat family did the right thing by going to the media right away and not hiding it. They made it clear that they would fight, and right from the start, they brought in the best lawyers, and they had the investigation under their control. So that was her family's intention, to get to the truth at any cost. That we're going to the media, we're going to talk to all the TV channels, yeah, and we're going to talk about it openly. And people immediately believed them. So then anyone, you know, any functionary, official, or police officer, they're all afraid of public exposure. They all knew that if it got a lot of publicity, then of course people would look into it and see that there were improprieties. And they just left them no choice. But despite that, there was still some misconduct in the investigation. They still found some, albeit small, but issues nonetheless. And so throughout the Sultanat case, we all saw how it resonated with the public. Not being afraid and telling the media that scary things like this are happening in Kazakhstan is the right thing to do.
So you're saying the key factor here is transparency.
Transparency, yeah. Because, well, they left us no choice. The investigators didn't give us a choice, nor did the government. We only get results through public awareness, but it shouldn't have to be. We should be able to just go to the police and get help. But there's no such thing here. The police don't provide assistance. We've been operating here for almost 8 years. In July, it'll be eight. And in those 8 years, we've been able to bring 251 cases to court, to a verdict. It's 250 people who've committed rape, murder, crimes against minors. It's police officers who didn't provide assistance in time, and people died because of them. And there are even more cases that we couldn't bring to trial, 4 or 5 times more. And people come to our nonprofit, Nimalchi. Don't be silent for this exact reason, because the police don't take any action.
Since you've already brought up your own work, I don't want to ask you to share more than you're comfortable with, but could you talk briefly about your personal story, how you started the Nimalchi Foundation, and what consequences you faced for your activism and your work?
In July 2016, I wrote a fairly candid post that I put on Facebook. The post was about how I survived gang rape when I was a child and no one was punished for it. How I kept silent for many years and that I think it's wrong because, you know, it's been over 25 years since that happened and I know the fate of all my rapists, where they are, what's going on in their lives. I wanted to communicate to women that if we don't talk, the rapists stay free and someone else will get hurt down the line. Most importantly, if we stay silent, the trauma stays with us. To cope with this trauma, you need to work at it. You need to go to a therapist and treat the sickness that sits inside you, preventing development, preventing you from moving forward. And that's when the movement Nimalchi really began. In no way did I expect that this post would evoke such a strong response, such engagement. And literally overnight, we received 100 letters from women saying, yeah, I was raped too. Thank you for starting this conversation. Plus over 500 comments on my post expressing their gratitude. And so my husband and I decided that we would start a foundation because there are so many of these women and they all need help. And yeah, that's where it all started. In 2017, we opened the foundation and set up a hotline that people could call and report what happened to them, so we could help them. That's how our movement started to work. Everything was fine at first. Then over time, we started getting a lot of cases where the police just weren't doing their jobs, some ministries. We began demonstrating that the laws on the books didn't work. So we started talking about how laws needed changing. And we were actually able to change the law on sexual violence in 2019. The penalties are tougher. We managed to make some changes to the law on pedophilia, the law on domestic violence. In general, work became very active. And when we'd already gained respect, unconditional respect at that, from the citizens of Kazakhstan, then we were really able to open up an international nonprofit in Georgia. And that's when the Kazakh authorities started to get worried, and they started openly persecuting me. In general, though, honestly, the persecution's been going on since 2020. But they brought serious charges against me in 2022 and again in 2023. And now a total of 6 criminal cases have been opened against me. I've officially been declared a wanted person and under arrest in absentia. And the authorities are completely obstructing our work. but we haven't stopped for one day. People come to us for help and they keep coming because people absolutely do not believe the information that the Ministry of Internal Affairs is spreading, that I supposedly embezzled money and fled abroad, as they say. Because everyone sees that we're helping, that there's 11 of us, for example. We work from Tbilisi, Almaty, Montenegro. There's not even a question of us being criminals. If you read our page, look at the comments that people leave, you'll understand that there's no one else to turn to. Because I understand that in Kazakhstan, it's scary to post about open cases and talk about how the police aren't doing their jobs. Because people understand that police can arrest them, put pressure on them, and file criminal charges against them. Just recently, an activist was arrested. He's clearly an activist. He writes about all the same stuff we do. But they're trying to accuse him of being a drug addict and doing drugs. And that's the kind of rhetoric from the state. It's constant. We're all afraid. We're all afraid, but we work. We don't stop because there's no one else to help. If our organization closes, I don't know what these women would have to believe in. There are a lot of them. There are millions of them. This happens in every second family, and while we all kept silent, it created a terrifying snowball effect that's grown to monstrous proportions. And the violence has become incredibly grave, because husbands have started torturing, raping, taking women into slavery, some just forcing them to accept that they've taken another wife. One wife isn't enough, so they need a second, a third. Women are completely deprived of their civil rights. And so, of course, we need organizations like Nemolchi.
In April, in the wake of the Bishimbaev trial, Kazakhstan passed a new law that strengthens penalties for domestic violence and makes it a felony offense. How effective do you expect this law to be? And do you think we should expect more positive changes at the legislative level in the foreseeable future?
You know, we have to expect a really big fight because the law, of course, is insufficient. We need to fight to make this law work, to get additional provisions adopted, to change the people's mindset, and first and foremost, reform our law enforcement system, because that's where all the problems begin. If the police had stringently upheld people's rights and acted in accordance with the law, there might not have been such an overwhelming public resistance. But if you look now at social media feeds in Kazakhstan, you'll see that every other post is some kind of appeal, either to the president, to the Minister of Internal Affairs, and they all say the same thing. The police closed my case. They didn't even look into my case. My rights are being violated. And this has become a clear trend, a really, really dangerous one. So we have a very serious struggle ahead of us. The law has been passed, but not completely. There are some provisions that will simply make life easier for women. But there's still a lot of work that needs to be done. I mean, they passed the law under the pressure of our public figures. You know, if they had passed the law having really educated themselves about the topic, conducting research, getting all the necessary information, then I would have said, yeah, Kazakhstan cares about women, but now this is all happening because they're under pressure from the public, and I don't see any engagement on the government side.
To gain insight into the significant media impact of this trial, I interviewed Alexandra Akanoeva, the editor-in-chief of The Village in Kazakhstan. Why did the Bishimbaev trial resonate so widely with the public?
I think it's mainly because the whole problem of the homicide and femicide in Kazakhstan is really widespread, but it was kind of silent in a way that people talked about it, media wrote about it, but mostly a lot of people, a huge part of the population, just didn't want to accept the fact that it's a huge problem and that it's everywhere. For example, some of our commenters were writing to us that you're just choosing these cases, but actually they're not so common. But after this case, I think the whole anger that was kept inside some people, both men and women, just kind of spread away, and they started speaking out a lot, telling their stories. So it's sort of like Me Too situation, but in our reality.
And it probably helped a lot with the use of social media and how there was just such horrific CCTV footage, and that just went absolutely viral, of course, within Kazakhstan, but outside of Kazakhstan as well. Do you think social media in particular really amplified the public interest in the trial?
Of course, yeah. Social media took a huge part in this. First of all, I believe that the decision of opening the trial and making a broadcast of the whole thing was kind of affected by the public interest, because the judge usually makes this decision, but it's a very rare case, actually. We don't have many open trials. Secondly, yes, many different medias were kind of in coordination. Like, they agreed on the topic of broadcasting about the trial. It doesn't matter which media it was. It was really, really well represented in the media, in different medias.
Yeah. So we got the result. He has been sentenced to 24 years. How is the public responding to this result, and how's it playing out in the media now?
Well, I think that mostly people kind of agree with this amount of years that he's been sentenced to. But there were some activists that were preparing the sort of a protest action on the street, like 5 minutes after the result of the trial. They were demanding for him a lifetime imprisonment. Well, there are some people who think that that would be fair, but you know that in order for it to happen, all the juries have to vote for this, and they obviously didn't. I think that mostly people are okay with this amount of time, but they worry that he might be released sooner, just like the time before.
Do you think that President Tokayev would risk that, considering how major this trial has been? Do you think that this was kind of viewed as a test for him in a way, this trial, that he would really deliver on what he promised, this new Kazakhstan would be born? And so far, he has not delivered on this, but this trial has really provided hope for people. So if he allowed for Bushenbaev to be released early, don't you think it would cause such uproar?
I think it would, of course. That's why I don't think that he would do that. I think he understands that it's not really a wise decision. And plus, I don't really think that he has any reasons to release him sooner or making the whole thing not so tough for him. I also think that it's a political step for him. For example, again, opening the trial and taking the whole process on his personal responsibility, giving so much attention from the president. He wants to show that we sort of have a democracy, that he agrees with the public.
He said about how domestic violence is really deeply ingrained in the cultural fabric of society, to the extent that people don't even, they either don't believe that it really exists or that it is a family issue not to kind of meddle in. Will any sort of legislation passed by the authorities even make a dent, considering how ingrained it is within the cultural fabric of society?
I think that it, of course, will make some difference, but as I believe, and many other people I think would agree with me on that, the police department itself should be reformed to make it actually work, because legislation can be good actually, but the thing is that the policemen themselves, they close a lot of cases. They don't want to investigate them because they don't think that it's important. But now, since we have the law, well, so far it's kind of working. We have other cases of that. For example, Satyan Mamash, the diplomat who was beating his wife, well, now he was removed from his position and criminal proceedings were initiated. And many cases like that now are opening up because women speak up. And so far, we see the good result. But of course, there will be other cases where the police will not do anything. But thanks to the media, again, we can cover this. And after we cover these topics and tell this news to the public, I think they can change, because we attract attention to this.
Thanks for tuning in, folks. This has been The Naked Pravda, a podcast from Medusa in English. Remember that undesirable status back in Russia means our entire news outlet now relies on readers and listeners around the world to support our work. Please visit our website for information about how to become a contributor with one-time or recurring pledges. Thanks again. Until next week.
Thank you.